Good morning, and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. I'm glad to see that some of you braved the day after Christmas to come out and hear a really good sermon this morning. My name is Chris Pesky, and I'll be this morning's board rep. Please see the back of your order of service and for announcements about church life and activities, and feel free to take one of those home with you. I have no other announcements this morning, so please feel free to greet those around you. If you're visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please feel free to sign the guest ledger on the visitors table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you've been visiting and would like to become a member, I can help you with that as well. If you're visiting with your children today, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along with them and observe the class, you can do so. The nursery is just outside the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's a need for child care during the service. Religious education classes end at 11:15, at which time you can pick up your children from their classes. Today we have a joint RE, winter solstice celebration, with all ages together. And we will be taking the children outside. If we always enjoy getting to know our guests. If anyone is a guest today and would feel free introducing themselves, now would be a good time to do so. Welcome. That was brave. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion about the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode during the service. Today's service is going to be given by Barb Adams, and I hope you enjoy it.
Good morning. So nice to see you all here. Our opening words this morning are by Julian of Norwich. Be a gardener, dig a ditch, toil and sweat and turn the earth upside down, and seek the deepness and water the plants in time. Continue this labor and make sweet floods to run and noble and abundant fruits to spring. Take this food and drink and carry it to God as your true worship. We will sing our opening hymn number 15, The Lone Wild Bird.
Please join in singing the chalice lighting song. It's in your order of service. Now we have the story for all ages. And do we have any children with us today who would like to come up and have a good story? Dealing with change, a house for her.
don't make a noise. How's that? Tuck that in. All right.
Time to move, said Hermit Crab one day in January. I've grown too big for this little shell. He felt safe and snug in his shell, but now it was too snug. Hermit Crab stepped out of the shell and onto the floor of the ocean. But it was frightening out in the open big sea without a shell to hide in. What if a big fish comes along and attacks me, he thought. I must find a new home soon. Early in February, Hermit Crab found just the house he was looking for. It was a big shell and strong. He moved right in, wiggling and waggling about inside to see how it felt. It felt just right. But it looked so plain, thought Hermit Crab. In March, Hermit Crab met some sea anemones. They swayed gently back and forth in the water. How beautiful you are, said Hermit. Would one of you be willing to come and live on my house? It's so plain it needs you. I'll come, whispered a small sea anemone. Gently, Hermit Crab picked it up with his claw and put it on his shell. In April, Hermit Crab passed a flock of starfish moving slowly along the seafloor. How handsome you are, said Hermit Crab. Would one of you be willing to decorate my house? I would, signaled a little sea star. Carefully, Hermit Crab picked it up with his claw and put it on his house. In May, Hermit Crab discovered some coral. They were hard and didn't move. How pretty you are, said Hermit Crab. Would one of you be willing to help make my house more beautiful? I would, creaked a crusty coral. Gingerly, Hermit Crab picked it up with his claw and placed it on his shell. In June, Hermit Crab came to a group of snails crawling over a rock on the ocean floor. They grazed as they went, picking up algae and bits of debris and leaving a neat path behind them. How tidy and hardworking you are, said Hermit Crab. Would one of you be willing to come and clean my house? I would, offered one of the snails. Happily, Hermit Crab picked it up with his claw and placed it on his shell. In July, Hermit Crab came upon several sea urchins. They had sharp, prickly needles. How fierce you look, said Hermit Crab. Would one of you be willing to protect my house? I would, answered a spiky sea urchin. Gratefully, Hermit Crab picked it up with his claw and placed it near his shell. In August, Hermit Crab and his friends wandered into a forest of seaweed. It's so dark here, thought Hermit Crab. How dim it is, murmured the sea anemone. How gloomy it is, whispered the starfish. How murky it is, complained the coral. I can't see, said the snail. It's like nighttime, said the sea urchin. In September, Hermit Crab spotted a school of lanternfish darting through the dark water. How bright you are, said Hermit Crab. Would one of you be willing to light up our house? I would, replied one of the lanternfish, and it swam over near the shell. In October, Hermit Crab approached a pile of smooth pebbles. How sturdy you are, said Hermit Crab. Would you mind if I rearranged you? Not at all, said the pebbles. Hermit Crab picked them up one by one with his claw and built a wall around his shell. Now my house is perfect, cheered Hermit Crab. But in November, Hermit Crab felt that his shell seemed a bit too small. Little by little over the year, Hermit Crab had grown. Soon he would have to find another, bigger home. But he had come to love his friends, the sea anemone, the starfish, the coral, the sea urchin, the snail, the lanternfish, and even the smooth pebbles. They have been so good to me, thought Hermit Crab. They are like a family. How can I ever leave them? In December,
A smaller hermit crab passed by. "I have outgrown my shell," she said. "Would you know of a place for me?" "I have outgrown my house, too," answered Hermit Crab. "I must move on." "You are welcome to live here, but you must promise to be good to my friends." "I promise," said the little crab. The following January, Hermit Crab stepped out and the little crab moved in. "Couldn't stay in that little shell forever," said Hermit Crab as he waved goodbye. The ocean floor looked wider than he had remembered, but Hermit Crab wasn't afraid. Soon he spied the perfect house, a big empty shell. It looked a little plain, but sponges, barnacles, clownfish, sand dollars, electric eels. Oh, there are so many possibilities. I can't wait to get started.
The end. Thank you.
And this is the time in our service that we collect the offertory to support our spiritual community. If you are visiting today, please know that you are a guest and you are welcome, and no offering is expected from you. Our ushers will now pass the baskets. This is the time in our service when we share our deepest concerns and great joys with each other in our spiritual community. If you have a joy or a concern that you'd like to share, please raise your hand and we'll start our minute of silent meditation with the following words. Let us open our minds and hearts to the place of quiet, to the silent prayer of the healing of pain, and the soft, gentle coming of love.
please join with us in singing our next hymn? It's on page 352, Find a Stillness. And please stand as you're willing and able.
Our sermon today is called Holding Fast, and it's by Kelly Weissman Asperth Jackson. The world is a slippery sort of thing. It can be hard, very hard, to hold on to the many pieces of life. In our days on this earth, we may try new ideas, new plans, new relationships, careers, or places to live. No matter how many or how few sorts of things we devote our living to, we can be assured that not all of them will last. There's plenty of trial and error to life. What was familiar and sustaining will sometimes pass away, and what is exciting and new and untested does not always transform into a well-established part of our deeper selves. Sometimes, despite our best efforts and finest intentions, some piece of the world proves too slippery for us to hold on to. In his unpublished essay, Why I Gave Up Zen, contemporary science journalist John Horgan tells the story of his ill-fated attempt to take a course in Zen Buddhist meditation. Coming with hopes of developing a spiritual practice that would contribute to his overall well-being, he found himself constantly distracted by frustrations that his internal critic could neither ignore nor forgive. Chief among these frustrations, he admits, were some of his classmates. He writes, "The worst was cell phone man, so called because the first time he came to our class, his cell phone beeper kept going off. During seated meditation, he also infuriated me by yawning, sighing, and twisting his head with a crunching noise. When our instructor at the end of our sessions asked if anyone had questions or comments, cell phone man invariably piped up loudly. Once he told us that something amazing had happened to him the previous weekend. All the thoughts in his head began spontaneously to turn into songs, and he realized that creation is nothing more than God turning silence into song, which is really just vibrations and, you know, energy." Eventually, John Horgan took his frustrations and mental conflict about the class out into the snow with him, attempting to practice mindfulness while cross-country skiing. But even the cold simplicity of fresh snow and white sky could not save him from his wandering mind and all the sights and thoughts that intruded upon him as he tried desperately to be here now. After berating himself repeatedly for stray thoughts as varied as his daughter's cold, his wife's social activism, and his curiosity about the animal tracks crossing his path through the woods, Horgan finally gave up on the spiritual practice he was cultivating. It can be a hard thing to acknowledge to others and to ourselves that some goal, some challenge, some want of ours is beyond our grasp. Even when the job just wasn't right for us, or the marriage wasn't good for either of us, or that dream we were following took us down a path we could not follow. Even if we know in our minds that letting go is the right thing to do, it can be so hard and so painful to let go with our hearts. Yet our lives are shaped not only by what we carry with us, by also what we have left behind. Unitarian Universalism, the religion, this is author speaking, to which I was born, deeply values search, ongoing growth, and the discovery of new ideas, thoughts, and perspectives. Often, we find that our free and responsible search for truth and meaning requires us to leave behind what is familiar, inherited, or traditional. No less a prophet of this movement than William Ellery Channing expressed some of this sentiment when he wrote, "I call that mind free which resists the bondage of habit, which does not mechanically repeat itself and copy the past, which does not live on in old virtue, which does not enslave itself to precise rules, but forgets what is behind, listens for new and higher monitions of conscience, and rejoices to pour in fresh and higher exertions." These are brave words, ones that match the brave work of going out, of finding what is new and unfamiliar, and of questing for the truth, wherever it may lead. There are times when leaving where we are and letting go of what has been is necessary for growth or for justice or for peace or for survival. Many of us I know have come to be Unitarian Universalists by coming out of some other religious tradition and perhaps leaving it behind. Our faith urges us to seek so far and so wide for meaning that we reach beyond the bounds of what is known and familiar to Unitarian Universalists and our theological ancestors. But just as there is reason to celebrate letting go, there is also reason to holding fast, to honor holding fast, living with a persistent commitment to something larger than oneself. Unitarian Universalism is today a faith of joiners. If it were not for the more than half of us who have come in by choice made later in life, rather than entering by birth or upbringing, we could not be what we are. But it is only the bravery to join that sustains this or any other religion. It is also the courage to stay. In our congregations and amongst ourselves, it is somewhat common to exchange tales of the faith that we left behind in order to become Unitarian Universalists. For some of us, this is an opportunity to reveal and perhaps heal wounds from our previous religious lives. What I wish for and would one day hope to see are spaces made for those Unitarian Universalists, both joiners and lifers, who have had their hearts broken by this faith and who, despite those wounds, are still here. The poet Robert Frost describes steadfast and abiding commitment with these brief words: "The heart can think of no devotion greater than being sure to ocean, holding the curve of one position, counting an endless repetition." What things in life require this persistence? The practice of religion, the exercise of citizenship, the construction and maintenance of an institution, such as partnership, a family, or an association of congregations. All these things and many more need lasting and abiding effort in order to endure. The institutions and identities by which we define ourselves are only so strong and so permanent as the human commitments out of which they are made. The author speaks. I live in Boston and have found that my audiences need no instruction in the virtues of remaining true to a cause. Steadfast institutional loyalty is hardly a foreign concept in that town, particularly in the face of great disappointment and a Greek chorus of naysayers and false friends. Novelist, lawyer, and newspaper writer George V. Higgins offered the observation some years ago that the Red Sox are a religion. If so, I see no reason not to hold on my own religious movement to the standards of Massachusetts. I see no reason not to hold my own religious movement to the standards of Massachusetts Bay's largest indigenous faith. When I can climb aboard a trolley car on Sunday and see that no more than half the train is filled with families and couples and single people, all wearing chalices on their caps and T-shirts and all on their way to worship, then perhaps I will be satisfied. When I first mentioned the title of this sermon to a friend of mine who is long a veteran of the United States Navy, he reminded me of a traditional naval tattoo. Two words, eight letters, inked across the fingers of both hands to read the instruction, hold fast. The safe journey of a ship often depends on the strength and dedication of its crew in holding down or hauling in this line or that. The message, it is a reminder, it seems to me, that the common good of the boat relies on the embodiment commitment of all those aboard. I received poignant instruction in what it means to hold fast to something beloved while on a trip this last year to New Orleans. 15 of us from Boston's Arlington Street Church spent a week in the Crescent City, slinging paint and joint compound, hauling dirt, planting garden beds, and bearing witness. It is my sad duty to tell you that everyone I meet years later, that the body of New Orleans still retains the terrible wounds of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. I did not have the opportunity to visit New Orleans before the storm. Seeing the city when I did, as I was full of mixed emotions and images of both beauty and anger to carry back to my home. One late afternoon, our group took a solemn tour of the lower Ninth Ward, a section of that city that was ignored by the national imagination until the storms, their aftermath, and the American media turned that neighborhood into a spectacle of desolation. The Ninth Ward has been the heart of the working-class black population of New Orleans for generations. Hit by the very worst of the catastrophic flooding that New Orleans experienced in the late summer of 2005, the lower ninth was almost uniformly flattened. Staring out at what used to be several acres of well-loved homes, I saw whole blocks of houses reduced to vacant lots, their contents spilled out on rubble, and grass with little sets of concrete steps leading up to front doorways that are no longer there. It is the sort of view that makes the human soul grow coarse, to survey the consequences of a broken canal, wrought by human hands, ordered by human minds, uncaring of the risk it posed to the human lives beside its walls. Seeing all those broken houses stirred in me feelings of both anger and grief. Carrying those feelings with me still is one of the costs and one of the gifts of that journey south. But here is the lesson I offer from it today. Amidst the ruin and the rot, there stood a dirty white trailer. It was a sort furnished by FEMA or rented from a private company and used by pre-Katrina residents who have returned to the Gulf Coast to build their broken homes. In a neighborhood that was all but completely empty, largely devoid of standing houses, let alone of people to live in them, this trailer made a bold statement. "I am here," it seemed to say. "I will hold this place, my home. I will not be moved." In his speech to the divinity students of Manchester College, Oxford, in the fall of 1896, Claude Montefiore spoke of the commonalities he observed between his own liberal Judaism and the faith of the Unitarian audience he was addressing. He affirmed that the seeking, searching spirit need not be viewed as incompatible with persistence and loyalty, that in fact, each requires the other, if either is to have meaning or purpose at all, as he put it. We are not less fervent believers in the reality of truth because we are more conscious of its infinite complexity. A love which realizes imperfection in the beloved object may be more fruitful than a blind affection which, because it sees no weakness or blemish, can strive for no improvement and attempt no purification. It is not a question as to whether we will in our lives leave things which are familiar and well known to us behind. That much is a sure consequence of living. Likewise, we need to trust in things outside ourselves in order to sustain our being. A tree needs roots. It also needs branches. These, then, are the questions before us. How much courage will we show in our holding, in our letting go? How much wisdom will we find to guide us in choosing between one and the other? Will there be honors for the immigrant, the convert, the refugee, as well as for the loyal holdout, the born member, and the internal agitator? What are you holding on to that you need to let go of? What have you let go of that you desperately need to pick up again? Instead of a polylog, we can carry on any conversations we would like to have about this in the social hall. My closing words are simple. We're all living. We're living to sort out the things we take with us and the things we leave behind. And we have each other to share in helping us come to those decisions. And that is the meaning of this community to me. Blessed be.